Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 25th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is a forum dealing with the opening of the mine and the problems with the site here. Let's listen in.
Jennifer Deere is here today, who is the project manager for URS. URS, formerly called Dames & Moore, a name you might have heard before, is an engineering firm hired by Intelco, and Intelco is the mining company that inherited the liability for the Holden mine. We're very happy to have Jennifer here, not only because she is very knowledgeable about the project, but also after working with her on and off for the last 4 years, it's become clear what a good working partner she's been and how careful she's been of interactions with the village and helping to make everything go very smoothly, and been extremely generous with her time, many of these forums and many, many questions over the last 4 years. So thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks for all you guys actually for coming, and you know, as Christopher mentioned, we've been working a lot together, especially lately, the last year or so, when we did some construction up the portal, and we really can't do our job without the village either. And we definitely realize that and appreciate all the help that the village has given us over the years too, because when you're out this far away from anything, you know, you forget a small thing like a tape measure. It's a big problem, so it's really worked out well for us as well, and we appreciate all the help. And I want to just kind of give you guys a sort of a rundown as to where we're at the site right now, and then give you an introduction to some of the remedial alternatives that have been developed in conjunction with the different agencies for evaluation at the site, so you have an idea of kind of where we're going to. But I want to keep it really informal, so if you have any questions at all, or if I'm not very clear about something, just go ahead and shout it out. Sometimes I'm going to go kind of fast through some of these slides. So some of this stuff, you know, if you want to know more about it, just shout out a question. And this presentation is sort of pieces of a presentation I gave a week ago. So it doesn't flow perfectly well, but it has all the figures and stuff that I wanted to show. And come on in.
There's chairs over here.
As Christopher mentioned, the URS is an engineering firm that we're consulting to Intelco, who's the PRP or the responsible party at this site, and who's agreed voluntarily to go through the process of developing remedial alternatives and implementing those alternatives at the site. So they've signed what's called an administrative order of consent with the various agencies that are regulating this area. And so even with the voluntary action, by signing this agreement, they've agreed to go through the process as you would if you were required under law to do it. So all the steps that I'm going to go through are steps that are consistent with the law called CERCLA, which kind of governs the remediation of sites. And we can go ahead and jump right into the next slide. Just a brief history for anyone who doesn't know. I'm sure you guys are more familiar with it than I am. But ore was first discovered at the site in 1887. There was some small-scale development and mining following the original discovery by Holden. But it wasn't until 1937, when Howe Sound came in and really developed the site, that it became a full-scale mining operation. Howe Sound operated the mine through 57, when the copper price dropped and the mine closed down. In 1960, they deeded the property to the Holden Village. This is a plan view of the site, and I want to kind of step you through the various features that we'll be talking about throughout the presentation, so when I use a term, you're more familiar with them. This is the village, Holden Village right here. Railroad Creek flows along across the page. The And there's three tailings piles at the site, which you've all seen. They extend roughly a mile long along the creek on the south side of the creek. They cover about 90 acres. And let's start back over here. We split the site into two areas, the east area and the west area. And we'll get into the differences between the areas a little bit later. But the tailings piles constitute what we call the east area of the site. In the western side, as you move way up the hill, there are several openings, mine openings or portals. We also call them adits, that are entrances into the various underground mine workings. Those go all the way up the hill, about 1,200 feet above the third level, there above the waste rock piles. And they extend down the hill. There's about six openings that we've located that are big enough that you could see into or get into. Some of them are partially collapsed, but there is airflow through these openings, and they are there. You'll see some of the waste rock piles that are associated with those openings when you look up at the hillside. So you extend down to what I think the village calls the third level, or the top of the waste rock piles. The mine called that the 1500 level. Now the 1500 level portal, that's the main portal into the mine. And it's located right by the mill building. So when you look up the hill, you see that. If you walk up there, you can see the portal opening there that we've been working at. There's currently drainage that flows out of the main portal that flows down along the road and then down into Railroad Creek. And we call that the portal drainage. On the same level of the mine, there's another opening. It's called the ventilator tunnel. This ventilator portal is right over here. And the two tunnels actually connect underground. This tunnel was used to allow airflow into the mine while the guys were working underground. They had some fans set up and some other engineered ventilation systems. There's two waste rock piles. And waste rock's a little different than tailings material. Waste rock is generated from rock that was either pulled out of the hill before they got into the really mineralized areas. So it's low grade, or there's not as much mineralization there. So what they did is they separated that out from the higher grade ore before they processed it. And they put that material in two piles on either side of the mill building. So these two piles here are called waste rock piles. The mill building is situated right in between it and extends down the hill to an area we call the maintenance yard, which is where the garage is and the water system. Further down the hill, the last feature we'll talk about is we call the lagoon area. It's right by the vehicle bridge there. As you cross the vehicle bridge, as you're heading up the hill, it's on your right-hand side. And that was used for settling during the mining operations. We used it when we did some construction last fall for settling as well of some of the waters. So those are the main features of the site that we'll be talking about as we go through the slides. I think that's all. Next slide. This is a cross-section of the mine, the underground portion of the mine. This, again, is the 1500 level here. So that's the main haul out, they called it, level, where they pulled all the ore out. The mill building's kind of situated, you know, along the hillside, so they process the rock, and then tailings would go off down to the east. The portions that are shaded are mined out areas that we believe have been backfilled by the mine during operation, based on their historical records and so forth. So you can see that below this level, there's a huge amount of mine workings. Some of them are backfilled, some of them aren't. Up above, again, this is about 1,300 feet to the top here, a little bit higher to the top of that big open void. Significant amount of open area in the mine. When they shut down operations, the mine filled up with water the water flows now through the easiest path out of the ground, which is through the tunnel, and then down to the creek. Next. This is just a picture to give you an idea. It's kind of a nice picture. You can see the actual mineralized zone, which extends at an angle, kind of up the hillside here. These are the waste rock piles down here, and Holden Village is further down. Just kind of a view from up on Martin's Ridge up there. Next slide. Just a picture of the waste rock piles. I know you guys have all seen this stuff, but the two waste rock piles and the mill building, which is situated right in the middle. This is taken from the tailings pile number one, we call it the very first tailings pile on the west side. Next slide. This is a picture of the portal, the main portal, the 1500 level main portal. We're called a zillion different things, but this is what it looked like in 97 when we first started doing work at the site. They were just installing a weir so we could monitor the flow out of the mine. It's kind of yellow because they've been in there working. It does flow clear normally. Next slide. This is a view of the tailings piles from up above. And you can see the village down here. So Railroad Creek flows, you know, along the base of the piles there. Next slide. This is another view of the tailings piles from up above. You can see some of the vegetation that's come in on the piles. All right, before Intalco got involved in this site, the Forest Service did a lot of work up here. They conducted a lot of studies back from the 60s all the way up to 1990. And in 1990, they did some work up here. They identified some issues at the site related to the tailings piles in particular, their stability along the creek. So they put some riprap or big sized rock along the base of the tailings piles to try to stabilize them against high stream flows so you wouldn't start eroding away the base of the piles. They regraded the tops of the tailings piles to try to enhance drainage off the piles. And they added gravel, about 6 inches of gravel, to the entire surface of the piles to reduce wind erosion of the tailings and try to keep that material from blowing down valley. Next slide. They also did numerous studies on the piles to try to look at different types of vegetation that would grow under these conditions. Oh, you got the news.
Sorry about that.
No. The Forest Service also removed some of what's called ferrocrete or iron precipitate from the creek bottom to try to enhance some of the habitat that has been lost due to the precipitation of iron, which comes from the tailings piles. And they added some limestone into the portal drainage channel to increase the pH of the drainage that comes from the mine to try to remove some of the metals in that drainage before it got to the creek. Next slide. You can see this, put this back up, so you can see the little vegetation plots that the Forest Service worked on back in, actually all the way through 97, George Shearer was up here doing studies on the piles and actually quite successful. We'll see some more pictures later. This was taken in 97. Next. So pictures showing the gravel and some of the additional, this was taken this last fall. You can see some of the trees and stuff that have actually immigrated in and are growing on the piles outside of the vegetation plots that the Forest Service put in. Next slide. This is a picture showing the riprap or the rock that the Forest Service put at the base of the tailings piles to try to prevent erosion at the base under high stream flow conditions. Unfortunately, the rock quality that they were able to obtain locally is really, really poor rock for this type of purpose. So you can, it's kind of tough to see with this picture, but it's really crumbled and degraded significantly. Next slide. So in 97, Intalco got involved at the site. They were actually called Alumet. Well, Alumet got involved at the site. Intalco is a successor to Alumet. We were hired to come up and help them with what's called remedial investigation. And that's just basically collecting samples, collecting observations to try to characterize what the major issues are at a site, so then you can develop remedial alternatives for cleaning it up. So we came up in 97 and 98, and we took a lot of samples. We took surface water samples from the creek, from the portal drainage, which flows down to the creek, various seeps, which you'll hear the term seep come up a lot, and that's basically when you look at it, for instance, a stream bank, when the groundwater rises, the groundwater level rises in the spring, and there's a lot of inflow, that groundwater will actually come out of the side of the bank instead of just flowing through the ground. You'll actually see it come out. So it looks like a spring or a seep of water. So we sampled the seeps in the spring of 97 and 98, took groundwater samples underneath the tailings piles and in the west area of the site. We did fish and aquatic habitat surveys where we went along the length of Railroad Creek. We split it into reaches. It's called about different segments, about 100 yards long. Did fish counts in each of these segments to try to look at how the fish populations change as you move downstream. We also did counts on what are called macroinvertebrates, the insects that are, they originate in the water on the bottom of the stream bed, and they're the primary food source for trout and the type of fish that we see in the creek. We conducted an ecological and human health risk assessment based on all this data that we collected and presented the findings in the RI. We also did stability studies on the tailings piles. They did quite a few studies to look at the stability of the piles under static or normal conditions, as well as under conditions that would be equal to an earthquake in this area.
What's the fish count? What kind of increase in fish count has there been in the stream?
We'll get to that, but I didn't put up exact numbers, but the results of the study did show that as you move downstream from the tailings piles, that the fish populations are diminished. And the findings of the RI point to the likely cause being the iron that comes from the tailings piles that kind of diminishes the habitat, reduces the bugs that are in the water, and also the fish. The fish populations do recover somewhat when you start getting closer to Lucerne.
Oh, for now.
But they don't. That's almost all the way down before they start to recover. So it's a part of a process that we're involved in right now is kind of try to quantify the extent of Railroad Creek that's injured, if you will. But we're not through with that yet, but it's at least for 5 or 6 miles downstream that the populations are reduced.
Is the base of the west portion, is that the base that you're working from?
From upstream of the site.
Mm-hmm. Is this a stone front section?
No. Okay, next slide. The findings of all the samples that we collected and the studies that we did were that the water quality standards that are set by the state of Washington as well as the federal government are exceeded in Railroad Creek during certain times of the year for cadmium, copper, and zinc. The primary sources of those three metals are the portal drainage, which comes from the mine, as well as one of the seeps that enters into the creek in the same vicinity as the portal drainage. So it's on the western side of the site. And in under low flow conditions in the fall, there's also a significant contribution from groundwater itself, where there's no measurable seeps coming in, but the metals are still getting into the creek through the groundwater. Next slide. So,
is there any evidence of that contamination getting all the way to Lake Chelan?
Actually, zinc concentrations are above water quality criteria in the spring, all the way down. Actually, in cadmium during certain times of the year is also exceeded in Railroad Creek all the way down.
At Railroad Creek all the way down. So the lake is impacted.
The lake itself is so large, and there's so much water in there that there's no measurable increase of these metals that we found in the lake, but they are exceeded in the creek.
Are the water quality standards you're using for human consumption or for fish?
The most stringent water quality standards, which are for fish. That's why these metals are a particular concern. We don't exceed this. The state criteria are the most stringent of all the criteria out there, and we exceed the aquatic life criteria just slightly during portions of the year when the flows coming from the mine are the greatest. And we can get into that here. The portal drainage, again, is the drainage from the 1500 level. In the spring, the flow rate of that drainage increases by tenfold. And it's during that time when the portal drainage flows increase that you see the exceedances in the creek. And cadmium, copper, and zinc are particularly harmful to fish and these benthic invertebrates. And trout are really sensitive to these particular metals. So we do exceed those standards, and we'll likely be doing some more toxicity testing to see how the creek water actually affects the fish themselves.
These two metals are all naturally occurring metals as opposed to metals that were introduced as part of the ore processing procedure?
That's right. They're metals that are coming from oxidation of the open void spaces in the mine, the walls of the mine, if you will. We haven't found any issues other than metals that come from the rock and the ore that was processed. So the portal drainage comes in again upstream of the footbridge, and the seep, that's the other contributor of these heavy metals, comes in a little bit to the west, right over here. So the western side of the site is kind of characterized by these copper, cadmium, and zinc contributions to the creek.
I've heard that arsenic is also, is there arsenic that's in that?
No, arsenic isn't a contaminant of concern at this
site.
How about cyanide?
There are no, cyanide hasn't been detected here at all. Although arsenic, we have gotten some measurable concentrations of arsenic in some of this groundwater samples we've collected in the tailings piles. And those concentrations, well, they're actually above the 5 ppb standard that's currently being possibly repealed by Bush, but they are right at that level, so they are detectable, but there's no measurable concentrations of arsenic in the creek at all. But we did find some in the ponds. Next slide. This is the portal. Next slide. This is the portal drainage in the winter. It goes along the road there. This is kind of looking down the road as it flows toward the creek. Next slide. Some additional findings include the reduced fish and aquatic insects that we talked about. The benthic macroinvertebrates, or the aquatic insects, were found to be impacted all the way down the creek. The populations were found to recover somewhat down at Lucerne, but they're not up to the levels that they are above the site or background concentration. So The insects are impacted all the way down, and the fish are impacted for a good portion of the creek and do recover toward Lucerne. The precipitation of iron in Railroad Creek was found to be a significant problem from the standpoint that it really diminishes the habitat, the aquatic habitat, for any kind of plant or bug to survive really on that stream bottom. The source of that iron was identified in the tailings piles. What happens is the iron within the tailings piles is unoxidized, so it's easily dissolved into water as it flows through the piles. In addition, there's some acid rock drainage, they call it, in the piles due to some of the mineralization that's left in the rock that's ground up really finely and placed in the piles. So you get this reduced pH of the water that flows down through the piles, picks up this iron, and then flows into the creek, primarily as groundwater. Once it hits the creek, there's a lot of oxygen in the creek itself. So that iron oxidizes and it precipitates and it falls out. And it coats the bottom primarily in the fall. And in the spring, when you have a good spring flush, you'll see that precipitate flow all the way down to Lake Chelan. So that was identified as one of the major problems at this site. This is a picture of Railroad Creek at the footbridge. This is downstream of where the portal drainage comes in. So you're at this point, we have elevated concentrations of copper, cadmium, and zinc. But you don't have the elevated concentrations of iron that you do further down. Next slide. This is a picture looking upstream, actually, at the base of Tailings Pile 3, which is the furthest tailings pile downstream. So this is looking up, you can see the red coloring along the base of the piles, and that's just due to the iron coming out of the piles and coating that stream bed. Excellent. This is another picture down by the Goat Bridge, which is at the far end of Tailings Pile 3, so the most downstream point. So you can again see the red staining on the creek bottom. Next. And this again is another picture, a few of these pictures here. This is the same location, actually. Next. And this is a picture of what we call ferrocrete. And you'll see that term come up quite a bit referring to this site. When enough iron comes out of the piles and starts to settle and cement the bottom substrate of the stream, so the rocks and the, you know, you can see these big, even large-sized rocks, it'll actually form a cemented mass, and that's called ferrocrete. And so that's what you can kind of see along here. It's just a very hard chunk of, it seems like cement. You could bang on it with a hoe and it doesn't break. So that kind of illustrates the ferrocrete. Next. This is further downstream. This is about 3 miles downstream of the site, and you can see that the stream bottom is still really iron stained. We're just taking some flow measurements there. Next. Some of the last findings of the RI were to deal with the tailings piles and the stability of the piles. The geotechnical investigation showed that there is a risk of erosion of the base of the piles during high flow events or flood events, that the riprap that the Forest Service placed at the base of the piles isn't sufficient to protect the piles from being washed downstream, or pieces of them from being washed downstream. And then there is a potential for failure of some of the really steep side slopes in the event of an earthquake. Next. This just shows, this is tailings pile number 2. So Copper Creek flows right down here, kind of down this, into the creek right over there. You can see how steep these slopes were constructed, and they have held to this point, but there is a risk of failure. And if that side slope were to fail, you would lose a portion of this top slope into the creek.
Is it a tarry substance that's kind of up? You see on that?
I think the Forest Service put that on. It's like a organic matting that had seeds.
Coconut hemp.
Yeah. To try to get some vegetation to grow on the sides, and it did. Those side slopes are really steep. It's tough to get anything to grow, although slowly things are immigrating in, but it's a steep slope. Next.
Do you have any comparison of the species and number of fish and macroinvertebrates in pristine tributary creeks of Lake Chelan or streams of Lake Chelan to the Railroad Creek?
Yeah, we do. We did some reference reach work over in Company Creek and Bridge Creek near Stehekin, where our biologists identified certain stream segments that roughly represented the conditions as far as like the configuration of the stream and that reach compared with segments of Railroad Creek. And we did do fish counts and macroinvertebrate counts in those reference reaches. And that data was all used to come up with the statistical findings that we did, where we're able to determine that, yeah, these fish populations are reduced as you move down the stream.
Is there reduction in diversity?
That is actually something I'm not sure of. But we do have the data, and I could even help you find it in the RI, which they have in the room right across the hall there. But it's a little out of my area of expertise, so I'm not sure about the diversity. I know the benthic macroinvertebrate diversity was significantly reduced along with the population.
Is the upstream portion of Railroad Creek pretty comparable to those other creeks in terms of the fish counts?
Yeah, it is. Although Railroad Creek itself isn't a big fish, it's not a good stream for fish populations. It's just the configuration of the stream isn't necessarily ideal. And a lot of the trout were stocked originally by the Forest Service. So they're not natural species to that particular, this particular drainage. Some of them are, but. Next. On the side, this is another view of the tailings pile slopes. You can see how steep they are. You can see the orange staining of the creek. Next. Oh, some additional findings here. The state has pretty stringent groundwater standards that are exceeded in all throughout the site, in the west area as well as the east area for different constituents. In addition, there are some soils in the lagoon area and the maintenance yard where the garage is that exceed standards for metals as well as Chelan hydrocarbons. Next. So this is just another view, a little bit closer view of the mill area and maintenance yard. This is the mill area, the maintenance yard, and then the lagoon. Again, down here.
Mm-hmm. Ask a very naive question, but when Howe Sound started this mining operation, didn't they have to show a plan of what they intended to do with all the tailings? And we talk about stringent regulations. Weren't any regulations in force at the time they started dragging all that stuff out of the mountain?
They were, and actually, Howe Sound had a real state-of-the-art operation. They complied with all the laws of the time, and their tailings piles were constructed in such a way, and their mill process was so developed that other mining companies would come in from all over the country, sometimes all over the world, to see their process here.
Have they been back to see what happened?
Well, if this site has issues for sure, but really compared with some mining sites that you run into in other parts of the country, this site's issues can be dealt with, where a lot of places that they're so large in scope that it's tough to even deal with them. So, you know, in all fairness, although there are issues here, and I'm not trying to defend them anyway, It's not as bad as it could have been had they not had such a good process for the time. I mean, they mined in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So it's good to kind of keep that in mind when you look at the site. But again, they did meet, they were permitted by the Forest Service to do all their work up here, and they met all the requirements of the time. Next.
Where exactly is the Mine Museum?
Oh, the Mine Museum is right here, right around here. So the road kind of, to give you an idea, there's the vehicle bridge, and the road curves up here. This is where the garage is, and then it continues up. I'll give you some perspective. Next. This is the lagoon. It fills with water in the spring. Just due to runoff from various parts of the site. And like I mentioned before, the soils in this lagoon area do have high concentrations of metals, and it's treated as a source area. It's a source of metals to Railroad Creek. Next. Picture the maintenance yard. That's a fence that we constructed this fall. Next. Okay, this fall, we did some work up at the mine so that we could actually enter back into the main level of the mine to look at several different things. One is the geochemistry of the underground portion of the mine, try to get an idea of where the metals are coming from. Are there some flows that are entering into the underground workings that are cleaner than others that could be segregated? We also looked at issues related to the stability of the mine itself. Because they mined all the way up close to the surface, we wanted to look at the potential for failure of some of those crown pillars. And also just to get a better idea of accessibility issues underground to do work in the future. So in the fall, we came up and we reopened the main tunnel into the mine. It had collapsed back, I believe it was in the 70s when it first collapsed. You might know better than I do, Christopher. I actually am not sure. But do you know when the tunnel first collapsed?
There was a flood about
late 70s. So let's look at the next slide. So this first part of the tunnel was constructed in the soils, what they call glacial till, before they got into the hard rock portion of the mine. So that first 100 feet or so had collapsed. Just with age and the timbers got old and wet and rotted and fell in. And so in order to get back into the mine, we had to do some construction work to reconstruct that tunnel back in. Okay, next slide. So what we did is, I'm just gonna go through really briefly what we did so you have some idea of some of the accessibility issues here. But we came in through the top. We found a hole up here that had a section of the soil had collapsed in. This whole area actually had collapsed in when the tunnel collapsed. But this left a little area, they called it a ballroom, where the roots and from the trees had kept the soils up here intact, so it left a void space. So what we did is we opened that up a little further and crawled back in there. The miners crawled back in there. And next slide. It's a picture showing us opening it up a little bit further. Next slide. Then once we were back down inside, we constructed a vertical shaft straight down. And what we were trying to do is we're trying to get back underground just behind that collapsed section of the tunnel. When the tunnel collapsed, water backed up behind it, and we weren't sure how deep that pool was of water in back of that collapsed section. So we couldn't just come in from the front and dig, because we were afraid we might release a flood of water once we broke through that last section. So they constructed this ball by hand. They actually did in there with shovels, just digging stuff out and drilling through the rocks to try to loosen them up and get them out of the way. Next slide. Once we got in back of the collapsed section, we were able to start moving in from the front. So we constructed a new tunnel back into the debris. Next slide. In back of the collapsed section, there was a pool of water. It was about 4 to 5 feet deep. These are some railroad ties that were floating, kind of stacked up in there. We had to pump that water down to a level that we could start coming in from the front and felt comfortable that we weren't going to release any water to the environment uncontrolled. Next slide. Once we got the tunnel all the way through, in order to remove some of these railroad ties and precipitates, metal precipitates that had piled up in there, we brought in a, it's called an LHD, stands for load, haul, and dump. It's a commonly used mining device there. So it's real small, it's a low profile piece of equipment that can haul about 2 cubic yards worth of material in its bucket, and it can go forward or backwards. So that's what we used to clear out as much as we could back into the mine. Next slide. That's a picture of some of the metal precipitates that we dug out and dumped into a containment area that's located on the top of the west waste rock pile. Next slide. This is what the new portal looks like. They actually used the old timbers. The Forest Service required we use the original timbers at the face so that it looked old and historic. So this is an old portion, but the rest of the tunnel is new. We also put in some doors that lock, and we tried to seal them as best we could to keep the airflow out of the mine. Next. And we did an underground investigation with the various agency personnel. Because we couldn't clear out the entire length of tunnel and remove all the metal precipitates and all the crud that has accumulated there over the last 30 years, we installed some bulkheads or some little dams to keep that material back but allow the water to flow up and over and out in its normal path. So in order to get all the way back in the mine, we have to actually take boats back through part of it because the water's about 5 feet deep. So that's a couple of the EPA guys in the boat. Next. Underground, we took a lot of samples to try to better characterize the water flows underground and where the metals were coming from and just get a better handle on the geochemistry of the mine. Next. We also looked at some of the different faults, the different fault structures in the rock in the tunnel itself for a couple reasons. One, just to look at the stability of the mine itself. And two, to look at possible locations for placement of a bulkhead. And we'll get to that in a minute, but both of those goals were what these two guys were here for. Next. We also went into two of the upper levels of the mine that you can still enter into. One is the 1100 level. This is what the entrance into the 1100 level looks like. We put a locking gate in there to try to keep visitors out and keep and we're able to get in and actually go all the way back in this level, and we got some good information on some of the flows of water that come in from up above. Next. This is just to kind of illustrate kinds of things we were looking at. We were looking at airflow, we're looking at water flow, and the stability of the actual structure of some of these big void spaces. Next slide. So with all this data now, we're actually ready to move on to the next step of the project. The agencies that are involved in the project haven't finalized the remedial investigation report yet. They haven't given us final approval, but we expect to get that in August. And we're going to move into what's called the feasibility study. And that's really what I wanted to kind of give you guys an overview of so you have an idea of the types of options we're looking at here. So maybe a little overview on the actual process that we're going to be going through as we develop and evaluate these alternatives. Next slide. First of all, there's three regulatory agencies involved in this site, the EPA, the Forest Service, and the State of Washington. The Forest Service is the lead agency. Many of you have met Norm Day. He's the project manager for the Forest Service. So it's his job to kind of coordinate between the different agency personnel to get concurrence on different issues that come up. Next slide. Intalco has agreed voluntarily to go through the first of all the remedial investigation to characterize the issues of the site. Then next is what we're moving into now, which is the feasibility study. And then they're also going to perform injury determination, which I don't want to get into too much, but an injury determination is conducted under what are called the NRDA regulations, which is the Natural Resource Damage Assessment regulations, to try to buy and put a dollar value on the natural resources in the area that have been impacted by the mining activities. And then they've also agreed to reimburse the regulatory agencies for all their past costs. Next. In the feasibility study, once we've developed a list of remedial alternatives to evaluate, we will evaluate them against a total of 9 criteria. The first and most important criteria that we will use to evaluate the alternatives by is the overall protection of human health and the environment. We'll also look at compliance with applicable environmental requirements, which include state regulations, local zoning laws, you know, whatever might come into play when you're looking at implementation of the alternative. Long-term effectiveness and permanence. Reduction of toxicity, mobility, and or volume of the material, the hazardous material. Short-term impacts, which can be significant in some cases, and it's actually a really important criterion, especially at this location, because short-term impacts include any kind of disruption of the village. Implementability, cost, and then state and community acceptance. There's one more.
Are those in order of preference or importance?
Those are in order of importance. As stipulated by the guidance documents that are provided by the EPA. The last criterion at this site is the extent to which the alternatives will achieve restoration of the damages that have been done to the environment. Next slide. So basically the EPA defines a couple criteria as threshold criteria, which are criteria that have to be met, if at all possible. And that includes overall protection of human health and the environment and compliance with applicable regulations. Next. The next important group of criteria, they're all important, but include long-term effectiveness and permanence, reduction of toxicity and mobility and volume, short-term impacts, implementability and cost. So these all come into play, but they call them balancing criteria. Next. Then there's another criteria, the state and community acceptance. They call modifying criteria, and community acceptance is actually really important. It's an important part of the process, so it definitely comes into play. But it's as opposed to the threshold criteria, it's kind of down on the list, I guess. What do we got here? What happens is we're going to go through this feasibility study. We're going to identify an alternative that we feel does the best job at achieving the objectives at the site for the effort that's reasonable. What happens after we recommend an alternative is the agencies will take a look at that alternative. They'll provide us comments. And we'll go back and forth a couple times and end up with an alternative that the agencies and the company agree with. Then that goes to public comment. and then all public comments are taken into consideration before a final alternative is recommended. And they call that a ROD, which is the final when the final alternative selected agencies issue a ROD, it's called. So next. Okay, I want to just go through the alternatives now. And there's a total of 7 alternatives that have been developed through various meetings with the agencies and evaluation of different technologies at the site. I don't want to get bogged down in the numbering convention that we've used because it's very confusing. But the alternatives are ordered in increasing order of action, if you will. Each alternative kind of builds on the one before it. So we'll kind of go through each of the different actions and how those will, where those will take place on the site and how they might impact the village.
Before you go on to that, what's Intalco, what's their incentive? I mean, what you've listed out, what they'd already agreed to pay for, basically. It seems like it's pretty substantial dollars.
It is.
What have they got that encourages them to decide that this is a good thing to do?
Well, you know,
I mean, I don't believe that they just say, well, gee, this is nice and it's a nice remote area and we want it to be beautiful again.
No, that's definitely true. It's definitely dollar driven. They agreed to go into this process voluntarily because they hoped actually that would kind of expedite the process, that it'd be more efficient if they were able to push ahead with some of these studies instead of having the agencies do the studies and complete the action and then bill the company and sue the company for the work. So it's actually more an interest of efficiency that they entered into it voluntarily than anything. It's not because they, you know, they're not a bad company, but you know, it's driven by dollars.
It also strikes me strange that somehow that they can be held liable, that if HowlSound at the time that they were mining here did follow all the regulations, and now all of a sudden, 40 years later, we say, well, it wasn't good enough, that somehow they can be held responsible?
That's one of the drawbacks to CERCLA. It's one of the drawbacks, one of the pluses, I guess, depending on how you look at it. From a company's point of view, it can be a drawback because they can still be held liable in the future, even if they did mine and meet all the applicable standards of the time. You know, if you're a community, that's a plus because, you know, a company is held responsible for the mess that they created. So it's the way CERCLA is written. Although Intalco did have insurance at the time that they mined, and they had environmental insurance, so they are actually litigating that very point with their insurance carriers. Because their insurance carriers aren't paying, so they feel they should because they did mine to the best of their abilities and in compliance with local laws and regulations.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Next slide. All right, there's a set of remedial action objectives. I know this is a lot of lingo, so I won't go into detail here. But these are objectives that we're going to try to accomplish with these remedial actions. The first is to protect human health and the environment, which includes groundwater quality, surface water quality in accordance with applicable standards, and then surface, soil, and sediment quality. Well, this is a unique criterion for this particular site, is to look at how each alternative will actually achieve restoration of the natural resources in the area. Next. The alternatives, or the selected action or alternative, will be implemented in a way that doesn't endanger human health or the environment through the implementation, which includes disruption of the whole village. Next. Let's go on to the next one, actually. The first alternative is under the regulation, we're required to evaluate what they call no action alternative. It's used as a baseline to compare other alternatives against. So the no action alternative for this site includes continued monitoring of Railroad Creek as well as groundwater. The installation of access restrictions to any of the areas of the site that are determined to be a physical hazard to folks in the area. We've actually done quite a bit of this already. We put a fence around the mill building last fall to try to keep folks from wandering into that area because it is a pretty dangerous area. We also put access restrictions in the open adits and portals that go all the way up the hillside there. These also include property use restrictions where there'd be limitations on building, for instance, maybe in the lagoon area in the future. Next. So that the alternative two, which is the first alternative where we're actually doing any action, has been split into 2A and 2B. And alternative 2A includes putting in water diversion structures, up gradient of all the features of the site to try to divert water that comes down slope from getting contaminated by contacting the different features of the site. Establishing vegetation on the tailings piles and removing or covering the soils that exceed state standards in the lagoon area, in the mill building, and the maintenance yard. And there's actually a figure. Next slide. So we put in access restrictions or airflow restrictions in the upper openings into the mine. We want to try to limit the airflow as much as possible into the mine because the oxidation of the surfaces underground is what causes the formation of these metal salts. And those metal salts are washed down when water comes into the mine, and that's what we see coming out of the portal. So one of the goals would be to reduce the airflow in the mine as much as possible by plugging up these openings. We'd also put airflow restrictions in the two big openings on the 1500 level. And then we'd construct a diversion ditch, upgrading to the mine features to try to keep the clean water from coming into contact with the waste rock piles, the mill building, and the lagoon area. Those ditches would be constructed to catch what we kind of call near surface water. Those ditches wouldn't collect all, they wouldn't capture all water that flows, all groundwater that flows down the slope. But it would capture a significant portion of it and try to keep that from contacting the site features. Next. In the east area where the tailings piles are, this alternative would include, again, up gradient water diversion, regrading the surfaces of the tailings piles to better enhance runoff off the surface. The Forest Service did a good job of regrading, but there's still significant ponding that occurs on the tops of those tailings pile surfaces where water is able to seep in. When the snow melts or when it rains, you'll see some puddling going on up there that we try to reduce. We try to enhance some of the, there's some drainage ditches on the tops of the piles that we would try to enhance and then try to revegetate or enhance the natural revegetation on the tops of the piles. The last action that we would do is pull back the steepest side slopes of the tailings piles to try to prevent any kind of loss of tailings material under a seismic event or under high flow conditions in the creek. We'd also evaluate different ways of putting riprap or rock along the base of the piles. There's other options to look at to try to prevent the erosion of the piles from the creek itself. And all of these components are common components of the rest of the alternatives. So this is the baseline that we're using to really start with. So it's kind of the minimum action that would be done at the site.
Jennifer, later on, will you assign some kind of timeline to each of the alternatives? This would take a summer, this would take a year, this would take...
Yeah, that comes into play. When we evaluate each of the alternatives, one of the things we look at is the time it would take to implement the alternative, as well as the disruption it may cause during the implementation, and the time it would take for it to be effective. This alternative likely wouldn't meet water quality standards in Railroad Creek. It would improve conditions at the site, but it wouldn't go far enough that we would actually be in compliance with state or federal standards. Next. These are the soils, this is just a graphical depiction of some of the soils in the lagoon area, the maintenance yard and mill building that would be addressed. We look at different options for each of these areas because they are different. In the lagoon area, we'd likely excavate those soils, put them on the tailings piles in a contained area. The maintenance yard, which includes your guys' garage, we look at just covering the area with a concrete cap so that you can still drive over it and conduct your business in that area. In the mill building, the structure of the building isn't in the scope of the feasibility study, so we're not looking at any options to tear the building down or try to stabilize that building in any way. But we are looking at options for getting the soils that are contaminated in that structure out. So we'd be looking at just going in either by hand or from up above and trying to remove some of the soils in the mill area and we'd move those to the tailings piles likely in a contained area there. Next. Now alternative 2B includes all the same actions as we just discussed for 2A. The only difference is instead of just putting airflow restrictions in all the portals, we'd actually look at putting in a bulkhead, which is basically a plug, big plug where we'd be able to hold back water behind that plug in the mine and regulate the flow of water out of the mine. And there are some advantages to that. Being one is we can equalize the flow out throughout the year. Right now, like I said, during the spring, we see a 10-fold increase in the flows out of the mine, which corresponds to exceedances of water quality criteria in the creek. So the thought is that if you can equalize those flows, you see less of an impact in the creek, you know, even for that short period of time. The other advantage is over time, theoretically, you would hope to see an improvement in water quality coming out of the mine. And that's because you'd be backing water up. We'd only back water up to about the 1100 level. That's the most that you could back water up in the mine. And that's about 400 feet. Ooh. So it's quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know? So that's like I said, the maximum that you would even consider. And it would likely just be backing water up enough that you could control the flow throughout the year. So we wouldn't need to go nearly that high. But you would reduce the amount of open void space in the mine that's being oxidized because it's now underwater. And you're also giving that water some detention time in the mine so that any metals that have dissolved and end up in that water have time to settle out before the water's discharged. There's some uncertainty with this, a huge amount of uncertainty actually, with the short-term water quality that you would see coming out. If you flood portions of the mine, you could see a huge degradation of water quality for several years. So this alternative without treatment is not likely to be an alternative that the agencies would agree to. But we have it in here because we want to look at some of the benefits of some of these actions on an incremental kind of basis.
Just a geochemistry kind of question for you, because I'm not sure I fully understand. You had mentioned before that mobility of the metals has to do with the fact that it's acidic, the water can be acidic, and that I thought I understood that they're in an anoxic environment that makes them more mobile because they don't precipitate out in that environment.
That's for iron.
For iron. Okay.
Iron precipitates out at a pretty low pH. When iron is oxidized, it goes from being called ferrous iron to ferric, and it falls out of solution. The process that generates acid mine drainage or that generates these acidic conditions in the mine is fueled by oxygen. It's fueling a process in some of the other minerals in the rock that cause the acid generation. That acid's actually what's dissolving the metals.
It's the sulfur minerals.
Right. It's all the sulfides that were also present along with the copper that they were trying to get at. So in the spring, you see a lot of water coming in the mine from up above. It infiltrates through the ground surface, kind of travels along these big void spaces in the mine and flows out the bottom. That water is very acidic. It's relatively acidic. It's not going to burn your hands if you touch it, but the pH is well below 4, which is a pretty low pH, and it dissolves copper, cadmium, and zinc, and those metals stay in solution at that low of a pH. So that's what we're seeing here in the mine. Mm-hmm.
Is the pH lower than 2?
No.
So it's not worse than 12.
That's correct.
No.
Yeah, I like to point that out a lot too.
Yeah, just a reference point.
Yeah, the pH of Coca-Cola is 2. So don't drop your pennies in your Coke. The next slide. Thanks. This is just another figure to show. We put air flow restrictions in these upper adits under this alternative, but these two bulkheads would actually be watertight bulkheads. And that's the only difference between the two alternatives.
Which two?
The two bulkheads on the 1500 level where the water's flowing out. Those two would be watertight. The next alternative is alternative 3. It adds a treatment component to the water that comes out of the portal drainage. So it comes out of the mine as portal drainage, as well as some of the groundwater that we see it expressed, it seeps in the west area. So our goal here with this alternative is to try to treat the water that's contributing to the exceedances of copper, cadmium, and zinc in the creek. So the difference between alternative 3 and alternative 2 is actually the construction of a treatment system in the western side of the site. So next slide. So this kind of shows graphically, the green lines are collection systems where we would look at taking the drainage from the portal as well as some of these seeps that also contribute metals to the creek. We would just direct those over to the area that is now the lagoon area, likely because that's kind of the low point. We would do look at evaluating some different types of chemical addition systems, likely a low-tech, low-power required type of system that would add something similar to lime or chemical to adjust the pH of the water to try to raise that pH high enough that we can remove some of the copper, cadmium, and zinc. Now, those metals don't precipitate out typically until you get above 9, pH of 9. So we have to do some pH adjustment here And then following pH adjustment, the water would be directed through a series of constructed wetland type cells, so kind of a natural looking cell that just gives the water some residence time, allows the metals to fall out of solution and before it's discharged to the creek. Now this is very oversimplified, and my description is very oversimplified as well, but we haven't really done the evaluation of the different technologies, and we haven't identified everything that we would look at here. But this shows you the general areas that would be impacted by our activities. We just have to direct that water to the lowest spot that we can and still have enough room to treat the water before it's discharged. So this would impact the area of the village right next to the road, next to the vehicle bridge over there.
But the road would remain?
The road would remain. Yes.
That sounds like a relatively passive approach to almost like slight acceleration to nature. What about doing something that is a more active thing where you're taking the effluent through a high volume process where you're very actively and aggressively segregating out those bad chemicals?
Some of the disadvantages to doing that at this site have to do with the remoteness of the site more than anything. There'd be a significant power requirement associated with any kind of active treatment that you would implement, which would involve the construction of a generator. And even with a system like this, you would have to construct, you'd have to bring in something, you'd have to install something to produce some electricity. So a generator is going to be required under this alternative, but it's much smaller. And if you start looking at the fuel requirements that you would need to operate, a conventional treatment system up here, it's astronomical. You'll have a lot of fuel coming in on the barge every month to try to fuel that system. It's going to be loud, and the chances of failure in the winter are higher. The more complex system you have, the more problems you have with it. So we're trying to look at more low-tech, long-term type approaches.
But what is the time difference between the low-tech, long-term, and the aggressive, active?
Well, that's the thing.
Because if it's 2 years versus 200, maybe it's worth it.
You're going to have to treat this water probably forever. So that's that. Some of these other actions that we take will help. Hopefully the metals concentrations will be reduced in the portal drainage through cutting off some of the airflow, maybe backing up some of the water, allowing a little more settling in the mine. But those actions alone aren't going to increase the water quality such that you can just discharge. So that's really the reason we're looking at the lower tech approach, just because it's something that's going to be there for a long time.
Once you cut off that supply of iron precipitate to the creek bottom, does anybody know how long it takes, or does something active have to be done to rise up the bottom and make it fish-proof?
This alternative doesn't address the iron issue completely on the east side. This alternative only includes treatment in the west area. But that is it's a good question. We've seen improvements in similar situations at other sites where they were able to reduce some of the metals concentrations, and then over the course of time, you have a few spring flushes come through and the rocks are agitated and some of that precipitate breaks off, and over time those streams start to repair themselves. But the big question at this site is how much of the iron are you going to be able to remove in the first place, and then after you're able to quantify that, you can start looking at what the repair times might be for the creek bottom. So it's a really good question, and it's something that's not very easy to answer, even through all the studies that we've done. But like I said, we worked on a site in Colorado that over about 5 years, which doesn't seem very short, the creek did start to come back. And the fish populations came back, and the macroinvertebrate populations came back, and the stream bottom started to look more normal colored. But it just really, it's really site specific. And it's tough to answer here because we're not sure how much of the iron we're going to be able to capture in the first place. Next slide. Again, this alternative three doesn't involve any treatment by the tailings piles. This is going to look at what benefits are we going to get at the site by reducing the metals concentrations that are shown to be toxic to the fish. And then with the benefits that we'll get through the revegetation and the regrading of the tailings piles, which we expect to be significant, by reducing the amount of water we actually allow into the tailings piles, we hope that we would significantly reduce the amount of iron and water that exits the bottom of the piles.
Mm-hmm. Are you guys considering putting a cap on the tailings pile?
Yeah, that's one of the alternatives coming.
These alternatives kind of build on each other?
They do. These alternatives build on each other. So as we go through them, I won't go into detail here if it's exactly the same as the previous one. But yeah, they go in increasing complexity. Next. All right, next alternative is four. And alternative four is split into two alternatives as well, 4A and 4B. But alternative four includes treatment of what water we can capture in the east area at the base of the tailings piles, but we wouldn't implement treatment in the west area. So the portal drainage and the seeps that come from the west side of the site wouldn't be collected and treated under this alternative. And what this alternative is intended to do is to actually look at the benefits of reducing the iron going into the creek and the habitat problems that that causes, as opposed to the copper, cadmium, and zinc. So I hope that kind of makes sense. It's the way we've designated these is a little confusing, but so basically it's treatment in the east, no treatment in the west side. Next slide. So on the west side of the site, we go back to an earlier alternative where we would look at upgrading water diversion, which is a common component of all alternatives, airflow restrictions, and then the watertight bulkheads in the 1500 level. So we'd look at regulating the flow of water coming out of the mine, but we wouldn't look at treating. So the disadvantage of this alternative is we likely wouldn't meet water quality standards in the creek.
If you make those bulkheads airtight or watertight, where does the water go?
Well, we construct them with a valve, a pipe that would go through the center of the valve.
To control the flow.
Yep, we control the flow. Okay. Yep. Next slide. So on the east side of the site, this action includes collection of what water we can easily, I shouldn't say easily, we can more easily get at, given the amount of space that's available at the base of the tailings piles. What we would do, or what we'd evaluate under this alternative, is constructing some collection systems, such as a drain-type system with a barrier wall on the outside to keep Railroad Creek out, but try to capture the groundwater from the tailings piles. That water would be directed into a aerobic wetland, which is just a wetland cell that you engineer to allow aeration of the water. And then you have your aerobic wetland plants that help in absorbing some of the metals before the water gets to Railroad Creek. Now the water in this that comes from the tailings piles is relatively low in copper, cadmium, and zinc. There's the predominant sources of those metals is in the West. The main problem that we've identified here is the iron that comes out of the tailings piles. Iron precipitates out much easier than those other metals. You don't need to raise the pH as high. If you give it enough air, you allow it some settling time, iron will start to fall out. So the object, or I guess the objective here, is try to capture some of that water and get that iron to fall out before it gets to the creek. The tailings piles are constructed, as you saw in those other pictures, right against the creek. So there's very little space at the base to work with, to actually go in and construct anything. You can't get a piece of equipment in there right now. So in order to pull those tailings back from the creek enough that you could get in there and work is a huge operation. Mm-hmm. And it's very costly. So we've split this alternative into two. One looks at this, what we call partial collection, where we would just construct the collection systems kind of along the corners of the piles. And the reason for that is the groundwater flows, it changes slightly throughout the year, but it generally flows in this kind of a manner. So it flows towards the eastern sides of the piles. So there's some method to this configuration. In order to make room for the treatment system, we would have to move Railroad Creek to the north under this alternative. There is some space in here, but not enough. So we'd have to put Railroad Creek into a different channel, which would be more straight along that reach of the piles to allow for some room for the treatment system. Copper Creek, when it is flowing, when it's not all being diverted, would flow in a channel as well to keep it out of the treatment system.
Doesn't Copper Creek contribute to some of the contamination from flowing through those tailings?
You know, actually, Copper Creek does not have the elevated metals concentrations that you see in some of the other portions of the site. So it hasn't been identified as a source. And it actually, if you look at the channel that it flows down in between the piles, it doesn't come into contact with a lot of the material.
Jennifer, how many feet is that moved to the road? I can't tell. I can just see school right there on the...
That is a good question. This would give us a couple acres to work with in here. It's less than it's probably 100 yards at the most. I'd have to look. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure, but I could definitely tell you a little later. Next slide. All right, alternative 4B. The difference is it would involve extended collection of the seeps and groundwater at the base of the tailings piles. So next slide, I'll show you the difference between this alternative and the alternative previous to this is we'd have the collection system extend along the entire base of the tailings piles. Now, the advantage to this, or you know, the potential advantages to this are you would hopefully collect a larger percentage of the iron that before it gets into the creek. The disadvantages, however, to this system are the implementability. In order to get room along the base of the tails to construct this type of a drain system, you'd have to move a significant portion of the tailings piles. In addition to that, it's going to be difficult to keep Railroad Creek out of your system, especially under really high flow conditions. If you had a flood type condition, you could inundate your system with clean water, which would just flush everything out into the creek. Under this alternative, we construct an upgradient kind of diversion wall to try to keep some of the water that flows parallel to Railroad Creek as groundwater out of the system. And we would still need to move Railroad Creek all the same types of actions as we discussed previously. The difference just being that trying to implement this alternative as opposed to a lesser collection system.
The groundwater intercept system, is that to limit flow of the alluvium, or is it to limit flow upgrading or above the alluvium?
There's actually a component of the groundwater flow that flows parallel to the creek in this area. And we would try to, the idea, the agency's idea is that this would be constructed down the bedrock, which is difficult to do.
And has anyone estimated how much flow that might
cut off? Those are the types of things we'll be looking at in the feasibility studies. Exactly that is looking at, you know, how can we do this? How can we achieve this?
How does the Forest Service feel about all this interruption of the surface of the ground and building diversion dams? I mean, they're so stringent with their regulations now about changing anything.
That particular alternative was suggested by the Forest Service.
Really?
So I think they feel it's an aggressive approach to trying to collect that iron. Next slide. The next alternative, this is an alternative that includes treatment in the west area of the site, the treatment of the mine drainage, as well as the treatment alternatives we talked about for the tailings piles. So this alternative includes treatment in both sides of the site, and it's the first alternative that has complete treatment that we'll evaluate. So next slide. So basically, it's the same alternative as alternative three in the west area. Next slide. And alternative four in the east area. We look at collection and treatment of the waters on both sides. Now this alternative, in order to implement this alternative, it's going to take a little bit more time to implement. The construction will be going on for quite a bit longer. But like I said, this alternative is probably the first alternative where we'll actually meet both state and federal requirements at the site. Next slide. Alternative 5B. alternative 5A and 5B, the differences between them are the extent to which we capture that groundwater again. We try to evaluate those separately because we do feel that there's some significant technical implementability issues with this particular alternative. And we don't want to discount collection and treatment at all, but full collection and treatment may be something that might be difficult to do. Next. Alternative 6 includes capping at the site. Actually, let's go to the figure. Next figure. Alternative 6 includes treatment in the west side of the site and includes capping the tops of the waste rock piles. So we put some kind of a concrete or asphalt or liner on tops of the waste rock piles to try to prevent even more, try to keep out more of the water from getting into the piles than we would just from diverting the water around it through ditches. Next. We'd also look at capping the tailings piles instead of enhancing the revegetation. So one of the jobs of the feasibility study will be to look at how much more of the water will we prevent from infiltrating the piles by putting in a cap as opposed to putting in a grass cover or a cover of trees or brush. So that'll be just some of the types of analyses that we're going to be doing. One of the disadvantages to this alternative is the piles are going to be brown forever. In order to maintain the caps, we'll actually have to keep vegetation off the piles. And they'll require some maintenance every year to repair any kind of cracks or any problems that we find with the cap itself on The advantage to cap system is theoretically, especially in the short term, you'll reduce your infiltration significantly. When you get a full vegetative cover, the differences between the two may not be great. But in the short term, you know, you'll cut off the water flow into the piles immediately with a cap, whereas the vegetation's going to take a while to grow.
Would that alternative fit in well with our plans for a heliport and a light plane?
I think that would work out really well with it. But it wouldn't work well for the golf course. The type of cap that would likely be looked at is like a liner type system, which would have some soil placed on top of that liner to protect it. The amount of soil that we would need is pretty significant. I'm not sure if we'd be able to get it. Locally, we have to bring some up for this alternative. So we're starting to get into some of the more intensive alternatives that would involve quite a bit of equipment at the site. A pretty significant construction component here where you'd have big trucks coming up, not necessarily through the village, but coming up lake and working round the clock on the tailings pond.
Where does the water go if it doesn't go? Yeah.
Where would the water go?
Yeah.
The water would run off the pile. It doesn't show this very well, but they'd be graded. So the water would flow to Copper Creek or flow around to Railroad Creek.